This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today our show is going to begin with a big issue for North Dakota and lots of Midwest farm states, because we're going to talk about soybeans and other commodities related to the trade war with China with Frayne Olson. He is the NDSU Extension crops economist and marketing specialist. He's also an assistant professor of agribusiness and applied economics. Thank you, Frayne, for joining us today.
Well, I'm glad I could be here.
How did North Dakota become an important soybean-producing state?
Oh, how far back do you want to go?
Well, I know that it's eighth or ninth in Correct. Terms of rank in the country, Illinois being number one, Minnesota being number three.
Correct. So it really did evolve out of the growing demand base for soybeans from China. If you go back about 10, almost 15 years now, we started seeing the growth and development of the ethanol industry. And on top of that, we also saw a fairly rapid growth in soybean exports. And the majority of those soybeans are exports going to the Chinese market. And so as the industry started to develop and evolve, there was an incentive to grow soybeans both in the northern and western growing regions. So you go from the Iowa-Illinois kind of Corn Belt region into the Midwest and the northern plains. And part of that was because of our growing conditions and soil types, but a lot of it was because of logistics. It was very simple to get soybeans from North Dakota, South Dakota, even parts of Minnesota, into the West Coast markets, into the large export facilities in the Pacific Northwest.
We've been shipping stuff that way for a long time.
We have been shipping stuff that way for a long time, but this growth and expansion encouraged additional development. So there are more export terminals that came up. The railroads put in additional investment in rail traffic to be able to get the soybeans to the West Coast. And, you know, again, it grew and evolved over time. It wasn't something that happened overnight. But that growth and development then gave the profitability the farmers needed to be able to switch to soybeans and be a major crop in the state.
Well, the trade war is now over a year old, and soybean farmers in farm-producing states have been strategic targets of China, it's fair to say here, I think, because it's a place of support for the current administration. How would you characterize the current circumstances for North Dakota soybean producers because of what's happened?
Extremely uncertain. And we've already seen some of the volatility in prices, again, based off of the information coming out of the trade negotiations. One of the struggles we're having is as we've lost a majority of the soybean market in China, we're looking around the world trying to find additional markets to be able to sell our soybeans into. And it's been a struggle. It really has. And so the challenge we're facing right now is a lot of uncertainty. I know there's a lot of farmers this time last year as we were coming into harvest, the tariffs had been on, big concerns about how many soybeans we're going to be able to sell into the Chinese market. But there was always this hope that, well, a potential deal is just around the corner. You know, we'll just wait a couple more months. We'll see if we get a trade deal. And of course, if the trade negotiations went positive, you know, all of a sudden that Chinese market would open back up and we'd be fine. But obviously, 12 months later, we're still looking at it, and right now negotiations are very slow.
If we were looking at soybean sales in 2017 as 100% sort of a benchmark, where would we be this year to China?
Okay, so and I have the exact numbers. If we look at what we sold to China last year, we sold about 27.7 million metric tons, so 27.7. We're just about to the end of the marketing year now this year for the total count. And we're at about 12.3.
So that's a significant drop.
A significant drop. And again, China being our number one customer.
China is buying from others and investing in other countries to build soybean capacity outside of our country. Do you expect the North Dakota soybean trade with China to return to previous levels?
I really don't. It will take several years for us to rebuild to the levels we saw the last couple of years before the tariffs were in place. And China's, you know, obviously realizing now the dependence they had on the U.S. soybean industry and the soybean market. They have Brazil as a fallback or as an alternative. That's where they're going right now for most of their soybeans. But they've already made some strategic investments saying we've learned a lesson. We need to diversify our sources. We will likely buy from the U.S. if we can get some kind of an agreement in place. but those levels are going to be much lower. So the supply chains throughout the world are actually changing and shifting and evolving right in front of our eyes right now.
And parenthetically, we're watching the Amazon sort of on fire, and a fair amount of the Amazon has been cleared in previous years to accommodate soybean production in Brazil.
A portion of it has. Now, I do want to be a little cautious because the major soybean growing areas and the expansion of Brazilian soybeans has really been in the eastern part of the nation, the northeast, and it's the northwest that is primarily the Amazon area. So there are areas that are being cleared right now, both for lumber and also for cattle, for rangeland. But most of the growth in soybean production has been in the eastward more portions, which is more like our Great Plains were 150 years ago, where it was mainly grassland and brushland.
All right, but China is also expanding port facilities in Brazil to accommodate soybean shipments as well?
They are. They're expanding not only port facilities, they're making investments there, but there's also been a recent agreement or deal between Russia and China.
Mm-hmm.
Southern Russia has, in what we consider the Black Sea region, which would be southern Russia and parts of Ukraine, have very similar growing conditions and soil types to what we have here in the Dakotas and Minnesota.
Germans from Russia.
Germans from Russia. You know, it's not by accident, right? So their growing conditions and climate are similar, and they have the capacity to grow more corn and soybeans, just like we did. That expansion is now taking place. So China has already signed an agriculture trade agreement with Russia to try and, again, diversify their sources. So it's not just the South Americans in Brazil and Argentina, but also into that Black Sea region. So these are once you make that investment, it's very hard to go back to the old system.
The reason I contacted you about this interview is I saw the recent issue, the August issue of the North Dakota Soybean Grower magazine, and you were highlighted in an article that was headlined Marketing in a New Reality. So we're talking about this new reality now. And you referred to the possibility of the U.S. or likely possibility of the U.S. becoming a residual supplier to China.
Mm-hmm. And so that's a pretty important shift. You know, we always talk about the quantity of bushels, the amount that we sold. But what I'm really concerned about is, are we going to be one of the first calls that China makes to get soybeans, which has been the history, where they call the U.S. and they call Brazil and start haggling over who is the best price? Or are we going to be the residual supplier, where they will call other countries and try and source their soybeans from other countries? If they can't get it someplace else, then the fallback position is the United States. And that has some important implications, not only for grain movements, but also for prices and price volatility.
Well, in the last year, the sale of soybeans to China has fallen by more than half. If you were looking at a crystal ball into next year, what would your future projection be?
You know, again, how are we going to get a trade deal, or aren't we?
Yeah.
And more importantly, it's not just whether we get some kind of an agreement or not. It's also the structure of the agreement. I mean, what kind of terms are we going to have? Now, one of the things leading up to the recent events, China had promised or had at least offered to start buying more U.S. agricultural products, kind of broadly defined. Now, we automatically jumped to, well, that meant soybeans. Well, I think soybeans was part of that mix, but there's a much broader range of agricultural products they're interested in. So, again, is an agreement that we sign going to specify like minimum quantities that they have to buy from us? Or is it going to be up to the Chinese businesses and the Chinese government to decide what they want to buy and when they want to buy it? So that's one of the big clouds we have over right now, is just this high level of uncertainty and saying, are we going to get an agreement and what does that look like?
And it's not just the amount you sell, it's what you sell it for. In the magazine article, you contrasted soybean sales with corn and wheat, commodities that sell the same amount roughly year-round, saying that soybean exports typically run from November through mid-February in terms of the sales peaks. Given the current state of U.S.-China trade negotiations and the availability of soybeans worldwide, what prices should soybean producers expect?
To be very honest, very similar to what we see today. A lot of that information is already kind of bid into the marketplace. The vast majority of the traders and analysts, the people that are buying and selling grain, not only in the futures market but also in the cash market, have that perception. That's kind of the working knowledge we have today. And so unless something changes, I think the shock to the system would be that we get an agreement. I think the status quo right now is We're going to be trading as we are today. So if we do have any sparks in the market, if there's any unexpected changes, it would likely come either in the political side of the line or potentially in the weather. Of course, there's a lot of uncertainty about yields and late plantings and what all that means to
this has been
production.
A tough weather year for the Midwest as well.
It's been a very difficult year for both corn and soybeans. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been a lot of attention on the corn market with late plantings and prevent plant, in particular in the eastern corn belt. But the soybean crop is also vulnerable.
The cover of that magazine, the North Dakota Soybean Grower magazine, showed storage bins along with a delegation, I assume from China, looking at soybeans. They've become very prominent additions to farms in this part of the country. Does that indicate something about supply and demand?
Yes. What has happened, so again, as we saw the growth of soybeans, we also saw an increase in the corn acreage. And I think a lot of the new grain bins that have been put up on farms in the last 5 to 10 years has really been stimulated more by the volumes of corn that's being produced relative to, say, a wheat crop versus a corn crop and being able to store those. But they've now become kind of our safety net, if you will, for the soybean market, that historically farmers would harvest their soybeans and store them for a very short period of time or sell them right at harvest because that's, again, when the demand base was. So we have this peak load of interest in U.S. soybean sales at harvest or a little after. And then they would store the wheat and they'd store the corn until and market that later on in the season. Well, last year all that flipped. The farmers were looking at the corn prices and actually the market was incentivizing selling corn at harvest or shortly after. Tremendous incentives to put soybeans in the bin and store it and wait for later delivery. So not only has the trade issues impacted the pricing, but it's also really dramatically shifted the flow of grain and when the market wants that grain delivered. And again, the market is signaling that, where some of those grain bins that were put up for corn are now being used for soybeans.
Frayn Olson is the NDSU Extension Crops Economist and Marketing Specialist and Assistant Professor of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at the university. Has the disruption that was caused by the trade war, and we've lost a big chunk of the biggest market we had, is there a way to supplant that with new relationships like Japan, the European Union? Is there a way to level this out or is that just hope?
Well, it's going to be challenging. It will be challenging. And let me explain some of the differences. When we think about the corn market or the wheat market and you look at who we sell those products to, there's a wide range of countries that buy relatively small amounts. So we have a lot of different places that each buy some. But in the soybean market, it's very different. We have one really big customer and then kind of everybody else. The other thing that causes problems is for corn, you can take a corn crop and feed it directly, or it can go from the corn, from the field to a truck to an ethanol plant. But in the case of soybeans, what we're really after is the soybean meal. The soybean meal is the one that has the greatest value for livestock feed. And in China, that would be for feeding their hogs. So you have to process it first. And one of the challenges we have is if we lose that Chinese market, which is the world's largest oilseed crusher, then we need to look around and say, well, who else has crushing capacity to be able to use up these whole soybeans? And that's been the challenge because number one in the world for crushing is China. Number two is United States. Number three is Brazil. Number four is Argentina. And then finally, after number five, we get to the European Union. Yeah. Well, we're not going to sell soybeans to Brazil and Argentina. They've got enough of their own. Mm-hmm. So our challenge is to find another home for soybeans with crushing capacity. And that really has been the challenge.
Norman Borlaug, a couple of generations ago, had invented like what we call the Green Revolution with wheat, and we have wheat now grown in India and everywhere. Now we're expanding soybeans in lots of countries, including Russia. So that has something to do with the supply and demand too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And again, I mentioned a little bit earlier about these shifting supply chains. Mm-hmm. Well, that also means that we're going to be looking for new areas to start growing these soybeans. And we're going to have some new level of competition. Now, realistically, it's going to take several years before a new country like, let's say, southern Russia. They've been growing soybeans and corn for a little bit, but it's relatively small acreages. It's going to take them several years to, you know, be able to do it and do it efficiently, to find the right varieties that work in their area. So this is not something that's going to happen in the next 3 or 6 months. But it is a trend, and it's something that I think North Dakota producers need to be concerned about is, all right, how do we stay competitive? What does this new supply chain look like? We will, if we get an agreement, we will be supplying soybeans to China. It's just what are the levels and when are they going to buy? How do we find these alternative markets? How do we try and develop these new markets in new parts of the world for the products that we're growing?
Well, we've seen farmers make planting decisions that have changed the look of farm fields around us. Is this a process that's likely to be jump-started by what's happening now with soybeans?
I suspect it is. Now, one of the things that I've had many debates and discussions even with some colleagues on what might this future look like? What are some different scenarios or the most likely scenario? And one of the comments that a colleague made was, well, we've always had these shifts. We've always had these adjustments. And my counterargument is, yes, we have. You know, if you think about driving down a country road, you know, you can keep it between the ditches, but at some point you come to a place where you have to make a decision, do we go left or do we go right? And in my opinion, that's where we're at right now. That's one of the differences we have is we're all struggling to try to say, well, what is this new direction and how do we make that as efficient as possible?
And we also have in the meantime, you mentioned this, the transportation for soybeans to the West Coast. That has been affected because there's less of it going there. And we also have farm equipment that is specialized for soybean growth. So these industries are being impacted as well.
Oh, absolutely. And again, we've changed and adjusted our infrastructure for the grain elevators and how the grain elevators handle and manage the crop, how much storage capacity they have versus their ability to load trains very, very quickly. And so these shifts and adjustments are going to take place at many different levels, not only the farm level, but at the elevator level. One of the areas that I do see some potential, it's going to take some time, but I do see some potential is to be able to export soybean meal instead of exporting raw soybeans. And you know, here in the United States, we have the capacity to be able to crush more soybeans right now. I know there's discussions being had about adding some additional capacity, but that doesn't happen overnight either. And so one of the questions is, well, should we process more of the soybeans that we have within the region and then try and export the meal into some of the newer and developing countries that don't have the crush capacity domestically? You know, Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia are some of those countries that have a growing population. There's an interest in eating more animal protein.
And selling a processed product.
And then selling a processed product instead of the raw soybean. And I know there's a lot of discussion and interest in that, but that doesn't happen overnight. I mean, you have to raise the capital to be able to do that. You have to go through the construction and make sure that the plant is operating efficiently.
Well, besides soybeans, we grow a lot of corn in North Dakota. And as we were talking earlier, that crop has been severely affected by weather. And it's been impacted again by some political decisions. Let's talk about ethanol and that kind of thing. Where's the corn market now?
So the corn market was probably impacted the most recently by some recent USDA reports where the USDA forecast came up with, you know, higher expected yields than I think what the industry was thinking. But added to that, as you suggested, is that there's been some change in policy, some adjustments in how policy has been interpreted, and some of the ethanol or ethanol industry has been impacted. So talking about corn just very quickly, the two big uses for corn, the largest use in volume is for animal feed. The second, which is very, very close, is ethanol. Kind of a distant third is exports. So exports are important for corn, but not as important as they are for soybeans. But the ethanol market is a very, very strong market for corn. We got five plants here in the region. These are really important things to our North Dakota economy. The problem is the profit margins have been very thin. Ethanol prices have been falling. We're exporting some ethanol into the Chinese market before all this happened. And so, again, these exports, even though they're relatively small, did have an impact on pricing and pricing opportunities. And the renewable fuel standard – so think about the renewable fuel standard as kind of that floor in the volume that we are required to use. And up until recently, we were producing and selling more ethanol than the requirement was. So the mandate wasn't really binding. It wasn't really – we were hovering above that level. Well, now as some of the plants are closing and some of the exports have been dropping off, that renewable fuel standard now is becoming an important criteria. And the current law has kind of a safety valve embedded in it that allows refineries that were small or adversely impacted by the ethanol requirements, they could get an exemption, so they didn't have to blend as much ethanol. Well, the Trump administration and the way they're operating right now is giving more of these exceptions than they have in the past. And that's effectively lowering this minimum. So the floor that we have is now lower than it was before. And, of course, the people in the ethanol industry are very concerned about that because, again, profit margins are very thin right now. And so they're very concerned about making sure that they have a market for the ethanol that's being produced.
There's also been some disruption in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And producers look very intently, I suppose, at what are perceived as planting intentions every year about how many soybeans or how much corn I'm going to grow this year. If you were offering advice, and I'm sure they're desperate to hear some, what would you do? What would you say?
So one of the things, again, just recently, about several weeks ago, USDA came out with a whole series of new reports. I mean, they updated the ones they had, and the shock to the market was the current forecasts were higher production than expected. Well, what I'm telling farmers is, look, the process that USDA uses to make those estimates is a pretty refined process, and they need to stick to the process. It's for consistency. Well, that process works really well when we're having kind of a normal year. Well, you know, there's always differences, but if it's a normal year, the process comes pretty accurately. This is not a normal year, and so the process they're using isn't as accurate as it normally would be. So what I'm telling farmers is, look, don't get too worried about what's happening right now. The perception in the market is we're going to have a lot of corn. I'm not convinced that's going to take place. I know there's a lot of end users that are kind of concerned about the size of the crop, and because it's very late. So the concern is if we have even a normal frost, there's going to be damage to the corn crop, damage to the soybean crop. Crop quality is not going to be as good as it usually is. Obviously, not as many bushels will be harvested for grain. There may be more bushels or more acres harvested for corn silage instead.
Well, the bottom line here is that the state's farm economy has had a lean patch for a couple of years now. How much stress is there out there?
Well, the stress is definitely building. And so one of the things we have to be careful of is not to put all farmers in the same bucket. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a very wide range of farming types, farming styles, farming sizes, as well as financial conditions. And you can't always tell by who's driving down the street what kind of financial condition they're in, because there's very large farmers that are doing very well, and there's large farmers that can be struggling financially, as well as small farmers. So size isn't really a good indicator. Age isn't really a good indicator. We can't be too generalistic about this. So there are some farmers that have been doing okay. The yields have been above average. They've been doing a good job of marketing. They've got a very solid cost structure, so they know where they're at. And then there's others that are really struggling. And so there's a lot of attention paid to the folks that are struggling, as there should be. In talking to lenders and visiting with them, they're also being having a greater concern that we're starting to see more and more of these farmers slipping into that kind of the red zone for financial condition. They don't have the financial reserves to be able to take another major downturn. I think we're going to lose some farmers this winter. I would not be surprised at that. The question is, how big is this exodus going to be? And there's a lot of debate about that. I think, again, verdict is still out until we know what kind of yields we get.
Well, it's been an interesting year, and we thank you for sharing your expertise with us today.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. It's always fun to visit.
Frayn Olson is an NDSU Extension Crops Economist and Marketing Specialist and Assistant Professor of Agribusiness and Applied Economics. Coming up on Main Street, we'll conclude our series of conversations marking the 10th anniversary of the Hunger Free North Dakota Coalition. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota Agriculture Commissioner Doug Goring says he believes the amount of soybean acreage will drop next year. Goring says the continuing trade dispute with China will be one reason, but it's not the only reason.
Because in China, they've had African swine fever, and they've lost 30, and some have said maybe up to 50% of their swine industry. If that's true, our customer is no longer there to consume that much soy meal.
Goring says he believes there are some things domestically that could be done to increase the demand for soybeans.
And to that respect, some things that have been talked about, at least in North Dakota or the upper Midwest, has been soybean processing facilities where we can crush those soybeans, utilize the vegetable oil in different areas, maybe for renewable diesel, and start to look at supporting more animal agriculture and consume a lot more of that meal that's being produced here locally.
A proposed soybean crushing plant to be built in Spiritwood is still up in the air. The Spiritwood Energy Park Association attempted to end an agreement with North Dakota soybean processors for a proposed $287 million processing plant. The soybean processors has taken the association to court for breach of contract. A judge issued a temporary restraining order to stop the termination, and a hearing will be held tomorrow in district court in Fargo. And as North Dakota schools report increased student populations, the state superintendent of schools says educators have an important opportunity to help the state with student retention.
One piece of advice when I visit our small communities and communities across the state about how can we help make sure that our young people come back home or that they stay here. And I think my standard answer has always been, make sure that they're engaged with your community when they're here the first time.
Kirsten Basler says often graduating students are encouraged to go out to the world and find success. She says efforts need to be made to encourage finding that success at home.
Make sure that you as a community of adults are engaging the young people's voices 0 to 18, because when they leave here to go to college or to trade school or technical school, they'll never forget that feeling of belonging and being valued. And when they have that feeling, they fondly remember that. If they knew that they were valued and important when they were 0 to 18, they'll know that they'll be valued and important when they return at 22 or 24 or 32.
Basler says today's students are looking to have personal success, but at the same time, they want to make sure they're giving back and are making a difference. She says if community can nurture those ideas, the students will know they can make a difference when they decide to come back. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. For environmentalists, wind energy is a crown jewel of renewable resources, until it's time to close the wind farm down. As Harvest Public Media's Christina Stella reports, wind energy's waste problem is counterintuitive to the industry's green mission.
Wind energy has more than tripled in the U.S. over the last 10 years. It's become a major investment for all kinds of corporations to signal their environmental savvy to customers, from the Gap to Budweiser.
The answer is blowing in the wind.
But what happens when a wind farm shuts down, or the turbines reach their 20-year life cycle? At the Kimball Wind Farm in southwestern Nebraska, Rob Van Bleet is planning the day's work, scrapping thousands of pounds worth of old wind turbine blades. Rob says most of a turbine does get recycled, but when it's time to throw away the blades, that's when things get complicated and costly.
Taking things apart is difficult. Took a lot of energy to put it together. It's going to take a lot to take it apart. This job in particular, there are 100 semi-loads of material that need to be removed. That's very expensive to move.
Plus, because the blades are so big, scrappers have to rent or build specialized trucks to take them to a landfill. But blades can be anywhere from 100 to 300 feet long, so sometimes landfills need to build extra space for them. That drives the price even higher for scrappers and puts landfills in a tight spot.
So if you're a small utility or municipality, let's say, and all of a sudden hundreds of blades start to come to your landfill, you don't want to use up your capacity for your local municipal trash for wind turbine blades.
Turbine blades are also built to withstand all kinds of weather, especially in the windy Midwest and Great Plains. A mix of resin and fiberglass makes them tough but pliable, similar to what spaceship parts are made from.
They're made out of an incredibly strong fiberglass. So the company brought one in as a demo for us to try to crush. And actually, our crushing equipment is not big enough to crush them.
That's Cindy Langstrom, who manages a specialized landfill for wind farm waste in Wyoming. She says the blade's strength can make it hard for landfills to efficiently break them down.
We talked about cutting them into three different pieces because it made the rates way too high to rent. The big crushing machines you see in mines, we just don't have that kind of equipment. It's expensive to rent.
Researchers have estimated we'll have over 720,000 tons of blade material to dispose of in the U.S. over the next 20 years. That doesn't include the number of how many turbines will be replaced with new, higher capacity ones. Carl England, a researcher and CTO of Global Fiberglass Solutions, says U.S. companies looking to recycle blades don't have options right now because the industry here is still young.
In the States, you know, the wind industry is coming on, but we haven't had a lot of decommissioned wind farms. And you go to places like Europe where it's denser and land is at a premium, and you're not allowed to throw things away, so you have to do it.
But England says he's developed a way to repurpose blades by grinding them up to make chocolate chip-sized poly pellets.
That can be used in a lot of different plastic parts like decking board and pallets and piping and those kind of things.
The startup opened their first processing facility in Central Texas this year and have leased a second space near Des Moines, Iowa. Back in Nebraska, Van Vliet will keep experimenting too, in the hope that blade recycling can blossom into a local industry.
Out on the prairie, there's not very much scrap. The idea is to develop the next technology. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this. We lose money on every blade we haul.
For rural areas that need an economic boost, Van Vliet thinks his risk of recycling just might pay off. Christina Stella, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative that covers America's farm and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, a discussion about progress to end hunger in North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, protecting families from fraud and scams, and helping more than 62,000 family caregivers who help make it possible for their loved ones to live at home. Creating real possibilities in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND. And by the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation, offering the Medora Musical ending September 7th, including the all-new TR Charge Scene, North Dakota six-pack rodeo legends, and Bill Sorensen's final year as host. Tickets and information online. Explore it, adore it, Medora.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Karen Ahrens. She is the facilitator for the Creating a Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition. She joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Karen.
Good afternoon.
And with me in the Fargo studio, Melissa Sobolik. She's the brand new president of the Great Plains Food Bank, taking over that position in July. She'll be sharing leadership roles at the food bank with Steve Sellant, longtime leader there, who will remain as CEO. Let's start first with a bit of a scene setter, if you will. What is the Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition?
The Creating a Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition was formed back in 2009. Some partners, including the Great Plains Food Bank, had just come together after completing a study on hunger in North Dakota. The partners decided, we really like being connected and this opportunity to work together, and decided to form a coalition. So that was in 2009, and in this year, 2019, we're celebrating 10 years of those groups being linked together through the Creating a Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition.
Well, we've been conducting interviews about the coalition and its various members since March, and this is our final one. Melissa, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the food bank. The Great Plains Food Bank is a big one. What's the size and scope? What do you do?
Well, we are the one and only food bank in the state of North Dakota, and we operate out of a 36,000-square-foot warehouse here in Fargo. And each and every month, we are distributing over 1 million meals to about 215 food pantries, soup kitchens, and shelters all across the state. And while I wish I could say a record-breaking year was a good thing, for us, it means that when we break records, there are more people going hungry. And so last year, we served 97,000 North Dakotans.
Well, since there are about 750,000 North Dakotans, that's a big chunk of the population.
Is.
Karen, how would you assess the progress over 10 years for the Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition?
I would say that there has been good progress made. And without the work of our coalition members, North Dakota would be in a much worse off place when it comes to the number of people who are food insecure or experiencing hunger. So with people working together, we have been able to have data in one place. We have more ways for partners to find each other, for partners to work together when possible, and reduce any possibility that we're duplicating up on our efforts when resources are tight.
Well, Melissa mentioned that the Great Plains Food Bank has been serving almost 100,000 people with food support. How many North Dakotans would you estimate would fall under programs covered by the coalition, the total coalition?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't think I can answer it. But what I do know is national research from the U.S. Department of Agriculture Economic Research Service shows that the number or rate of people, North Dakotans, who face food insecurity are about 28,700 North Dakota households that face food insecurity, which is a figure of about 9% of people in our state.
So that's a big number. We're talking about big numbers here, and you don't want people to go hungry. You think of food as we're human beings. We're sustained by it. So it almost has to be considered a right under some circumstances here. So how is the food bank funded? How is this operation sustained, Melissa?
Well, the Great Plains Food Bank is very fortunate that most of our funding comes from individuals just like yourself who respond to our direct mail appeals or they're giving online. We also apply for a lot of grants from businesses and foundations.
Karen, you mentioned 28,000 households. Melissa's mentioned 97,000 people. Kind of, these are big numbers, but they also are numbers that can be counted. There is a stigma and a bureaucracy involved with sometimes gaining access to food support, particularly government food assistance. Can you characterize for us how that might affect the delivery of these services?
Yes, those factors do play a role. So sometimes we have our senior members of our population who may live on fixed incomes, who may see food expenses and other costs of living going up, and yet they're hesitant to apply to receive help with food because they think, well, someone else might need it more than I do. We also have some people who I have a little bit of insecurity about going into an office that they've never been to before and are afraid that someone might see them there. So that plays a role here too. But I know that the Human Services offices in North Dakota are working very hard to reduce that stigma. The Great Plains Food Bank and its partner agencies and organizations are working very hard to reduce that stigma. In the school meals programs, the schools are working very hard to make sure that children go through the line and receive food and it just receive food as part of the school day.
Well, that's an interesting element, too, that we need to talk about because subsidized school lunches are sort of a measurement of this problem as well. And there are some schools I know in the Fargo-Moorhead area where maybe more than half the student body would qualify for that. So that's another way to assess the problem, isn't it?
Yes, that is a way. The rates of free families that are eligible for free or reduced price meals is a way that we can measure. And the good news is that the number of breakfasts served in schools have been increasing over these past 10 years. The number of places where families can turn in the summer to find food for children have been increasing over the past 10 years with unique partnerships and organizations working together to find the places and the resources to provide those meals.
Melissa Sobolik is the president, new president of the Great Plains Food Bank. You have been there for years. You've worked on other programs like the Mobile Food Pantry.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, actually, that came as a result of the study that Karen was mentioning in 2008. And one of the things that we found was there were geographic gaps in service, and people were driving anywhere from 45 to 60 to 100 miles to their local food pantry. And they were saving up all month just so they could afford gas to get to the food pantry and get one box of food. And we decided to bring the food closer to people. So we would pack pre-packed boxes in our warehouse in Fargo, load them up into our semi, and we would distribute boxes of food off the back of the truck in communities that didn't have a traditional food pantry. And while we started that in 2008 in just two communities where I was actually driving the truck out to the small towns, we now make about 27 stops every other month. And we are distributing over 2,000 boxes in a quarter to people who were probably going without before that.
Melissa Sobolik, president of the Great Plains Food Bank. Karen Ahrens is a health and nutrition consultant and the facilitator for the Creating a Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition, which is now in its 10th year. Karen, food deserts and grocery store closings is something we've discussed over the past several months about the 10th anniversary, I guess, of the coalition being formed. How would you characterize those issues?
Well, I would say it's a great thing that the Great Plains Food Bank is there helping to get more food out to more places in the rural areas of our state, because the grocery stores in which people can buy food in rural places have been decreasing in the past 5 years. From which the time we started keeping track, we've seen a 20% decrease in the number of grocery stores in our smallest towns of 2,100 people or less.
So that's a pretty big difference, actually. And that's a, sort of that one step forward, two steps back problem that sometimes can occur. Karen, you talked about the mobile food pantry, and you had another program that you also directed, the Backpack Program. What's that?
So back in 2009, we had a school counselor come to us from West Fargo, and she was telling us about a student who would beg for leftovers. He was seen going through the dumpster after schools. And when they asked him why, he said that he gets school lunches, but he has a little sister at home who doesn't have food at home to eat. And so he was scrounging whatever he could find to bring home to her. And the counselor said, is there not something we can do? And as the food bank, we said, well, of course there is. Let's find a solution. And so we started the backpack program, where we're packing a weekend's worth of meals for one child, packing it into a bag that gets discreetly distributed into the students' backpacks to make sure that they have adequate nutrition over the weekend where they may not otherwise eat. And we have teachers and counselors and principals all across the state who are implementing this program and saying that students are now coming to school Monday, they have their adequate nutrition, they're ready to learn, they never miss a Friday because they know they're getting their backpacks that day. And things are just looking a little bit brighter for those kids who are struggling with chronic hunger.
You know, what you just said reminded me that a long time ago, I interviewed a guy who was sustaining himself by what he called dumpster diving.
Yeah.
And that was just basically to prove to people that he could sustain himself and, you know, do all kinds of things without having to spend any money. But this is a real issue, food waste. Let's talk about the fact that we are this a very abundant country. We feed much of the world, but we throw away a lot of food.
We do, and really that's why food banks were created about 40 years ago. It was found out that USDA estimated 27% of the food produced in our country never reaches the dinner table. So that's not your plate waste. That's not your leftovers. That's good quality food that never gets made into a meal. And that was going to waste. And so food banks were created to find that food and get it into the hands of those who need it.
Well, sometimes it's called ugly food because
right?
It doesn't look like the great stuff you want to have in your produce shelf in the supermarket, but it's still good food.
Still edible. And, you know, that's what we've made our entire mission is finding that food and getting it into the hands of people who need it, who can put it to use right away.
Karen, has there been progress made beyond what Melissa just talked about?
Yes, I think that in other places like the food cooperatives in North Dakota and the farmers markets, some of them in North Dakota are helping people accept that the food to be good doesn't have to be cosmetically perfect, in realizing that much good food that's available to us can be perfectly excellent nutrition and just picked from the field and still be a source of good good nutrition. So making it more acceptable and realizing that there's more to food than its cosmetic appearance.
Well, there's also this boom in places to eat. And I remember a long time ago there was an organization called Daily Bread. I don't know if they're still around, but they would actually pick up from restaurants or places that sold retail food, if you will, would otherwise be thrown out and was a perfectly good prepared meal.
And I will say Daily Bread is a program of the Great Plains Food Bank. It has just been rolled into our normal operations. And so we are still picking up at restaurants, grocery stores, retailers, you name it. We're picking up every single day and getting that food recovered.
Karen, I know that back in 2009, when this thing got started, and you've been the facilitator for many of the years of the 10 that we're talking about now with the Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition, the goal was for a hunger-free North Dakota by 2019. Here we are, 2019, the calendar's running out. What remains to be done?
Well, we haven't achieved that goal. But the partners in our midst are working very hard and even improving their efforts, as you've just heard from Melissa. So at the end of this month, on September 24th, we're gathering together to take a look at some of the economic and demographic factors that have changed over the past 10 years, especially where they impact our children and our seniors, some of the most vulnerable in our state. And getting a better understanding and grasp of, even though many of the partners have been providing more food, our rates of food insecurity have still been inching up over these last 10 years.
And that's because grocery stores have closed, these food deserts. If you look at a map of North Dakota and you look at the definition of food desert, it might be how far are you from where you could, you know, reasonably expect a supermarket. A lot of North Dakota fits that description because they're, you know, Fargo and Bismarck and Minot and Devil's Lake and Dickinson and Williston aren't everywhere. There's an awful lot of counties without something like that in them.
Right. So, and on our hungerfreend.org website, we have a custom-made food desert map for North Dakota with the assistance of the Upper Great Plains Transportation Institute. So you can readily look at and see the places in North Dakota where people live within 10 miles of a grocery store and where people live more than 10 miles to reach a grocery store.
So that's a challenge that remains. Melissa, how about you? You said we raised more money, we've given out more food. Obviously, that challenge has been increasing.
It has. And we as a food bank a couple of years ago really took a hard look at ourselves and said, okay, with all of our numbers increasing, are we truly meeting our mission of ending hunger? And the shocking answer was no. And so we have come to the realization that we will never food bank our way out of hunger. It takes a lot more than food. And so we launched Ending Hunger 2.0 a couple years ago really to address that. And that is really focused on those root causes of hunger, which is poverty and education and transportation and childcare. Because when a person is hungry, that's not the only issue that they're struggling with. And that's one piece of the puzzle. But we really need to look holistically at people and solve all of those things and play a role in all of them to make sure that we can end hunger.
And Karen, that's why it's a coalition. It's not just food providers that are part of this coalition.
Right. We have gathered together folks at the very beginning of the food chain, our farming organizations, our agriculture organizations in the state, to health professionals, to Rural Electric Association, bringing all these groups together who have a real caring concern to make sure that people have a good quality of life in our state, and that quality of life includes good health, which is only possible through adequate access to healthy food.
Karen Ahrens is the facilitator for the Creating a Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition, and Melissa Sobolek is the president of the Great Plains Food Bank. Karen and Melissa, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, and thank you so much to Prairie Public for making these additional opportunities throughout 2019 available to listeners to learn more about the groups that are working in North Dakota to help end hunger.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141-member rural electric systems in 9 states.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 3rd. On this date, in 1909, the Golden Valley Chronicle warned that North Dakota farmers should be concerned about the Chicago Board of Trade. The newspaper reported on a conversation overheard in Chicago. Jim Patton, described as the great wheat gambler, reportedly declared that the board had to suppress efforts by farmers to market their crops independently. The idea was to have the board send out the flattering reports to help hold prices down until farmers gave in. Patton saw any organization on the part of farmers as a threat to the power of the board. The Chicago Board of Trade was the first grain futures exchange in the United States. It was organized in Chicago in 1848. It began as an informal association of Chicago grain merchants. By 1858, access to the trading floor was limited to members who had seats on the board. The board established a system for inspecting and grading grain to standardize the market. James J. Hill encouraged farmers to band together. He said that many of his neighbors had rushed their grain to market the previous year. Hill decided to exercise patience. He held his wheat back. When he finally took it to market, he said he made more money than his neighbors. He endorsed the idea of farmers taking a stronger role in marketing their crops. He said they could make more money by cooperating with each other and not being in a rush. North Dakota produced a bumper crop of spring wheat in 1909. The price of wheat and other grains had already been marked down. Senator McCumber also urged farmers to band together. He said it was in their best interests to join the Society of Equity, which had been established in 1902. The purpose was to organize farmers as a political and economic power similar to organized labor. It became a force in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and North Dakota. McCumber said the society was the best organization the farmers ever had, and it would allow them to sell their grain independently. Otherwise, he said, they would be crushed by the elevator trust. The movement eventually gave rise to the Nonpartisan League of North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
After more than 30 years, Pico Iyer tells us what he's learned about living in Japan.
Harmony is everything in Japan.
Seth Kugel shares tips for traveling on a tight budget.
The less money you spend, the less clean things are going to be.
And take it from the Irish.
I would say it's nice to see the cities, but the real part of Ireland is outside the cities.
Wit is a currency in Ireland.
It's all in the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, a new service will provide mental health support in North Dakota to address a need before a situation becomes a crisis. On our show tomorrow, we'll talk about it with Tina Jacobs and Sarah Stallman of Lutheran Social Services. And the Native American Hall of Honor and the State Museum of the North Dakota Heritage Center will add new honorees this week. And tomorrow, we'll share the story of inductee John Smith. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.